Hello and welcome to this week's instalment of Nucleus Investment Insights. Last week we spoke with Jonathan Rockford, a credit fund manager, giving us some real insights into the state of the coalface in the alternative credit market. This week we'll continue our coverage of the global credit crunch with a macro view as we progress through one of the most volatile periods in money markets that we've seen for a century. I'm joined today by our Head of Investments, Damien Klassen, and Chief Strategist, Davelin Llewellyn-Smith, as we discuss at the new credit ice age. And just a quick reminder before we get started to subscribe on YouTube and click the notification bell to be notified of when we go live or have a new webinar to watch, or follow us on your preferred podcast platform. And for those listening in live, feel free to drop in questions in the chat box below along the way to have them answered. So our agenda today, we're going to be looking at the shock so far. We're then going to be looking at blows to come. We'll then be wrapping up the Australian situation. And then, as always, running through these themes and the implications on the portfolios that we run every day here at Nucleus Wealth and the MB Fund. So I'll take the time now to welcome our two stars of the show. So we've got our Chief Strategist, David Llewellyn-Smith. Hello, David.
Hi, Tim.
And our Head of Investments, Damien Klassen. G'day, Damien.
Hi, Tim.
Fantastic. Okay, so we'll jump into it now. So we're looking at the shock so far. Frozen markets, fellas.
The shock so far, obviously a few weeks ago, markets started to realise that this was not SARS and it was going to be something considerably worse. And alongside the big falls in equity markets, we started to see tightening in all sorts of credit markets. And a couple of those, very important. One of them is the junk bond market, which is where you find the less creditworthy corporates issuing debt. And they started to break down heavily right around the time that equity started falling. And so what that means is it became much more expensive for corporations to issue debt. And that has continued basically right through until 2 days ago when we had our big bounce, and there's been a little bit of thawing since then, but driven by the various central bank actions, but not a great deal as yet. So that's kind of your first indicator. The second one, which will become more important going ahead, and we've got a chart of this in the pack, is the FRA-OIS spread, which is, without getting too technical, is just a spread between a bunch of different bank swaps. And what that means is, or what it reflects basically, is the cost of credit for banks in interbank lending versus a risk-free rate. So it's, how much more banks are having to pay for funding than you could get just from as a sovereign. And the chart has shown a very steep rise as well since the crisis began. If you look at the chart, it's actually not much worse than it has been since the GFC. It was about these levels during the European crisis at, I think it's about 54 basis points today. And that's well below the financial crisis highs that we saw, which were more like 170, 180. So far, banking stress has been relatively limited, but it is as bad as it's been since the GFC. And that'll become more important as this discussion unfolds. And so what transpired?
Part of the problem that presents then, David, is obviously is that our banks have just seen another 25 basis points worth of rate cuts, but on the flip side, the funding's just gone up, and so that sort of pretty much wipes out any benefit from that. So even though they're holding them back, there's not a lot of benefit for them either.
Yes, that's right. And so what all of that culminated in last week when we had, what really was a genuine kind of systemic threat in global markets as central banks fell behind the curve in terms of markets, where markets were at, projecting what the fallout was going to be both economically and financially, was we started to get dislocation in sovereign bonds. And that's something that never happened during the GFC, and I've never seen it before in markets over 30.
Actually, David, though, I guess the LTCM when the long-term capital markets credit, that you did see some dislocation in there, which was sort of similar-ish. Not as
okay,
bad.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah.
But I think that was probably more, and just for anyone who, that's long-term capital management. And so the basic story behind long-term capital management was that bunch of Nobel Prize winners set up these systems, which used lots and lots and lots of leverage in very safe assets. So what they do is they generally go short the 10-year bond and go long the 11-year bond because there was some pricing anomaly, and they could borrow heavily and make a profit on that. But it all relied on being so much leverage that when the whole thing came unstuck, everyone started trading against their position. And that sort of really dislocated government markets and needed the Fed to step in and bailouts and that. So, so to me, there were certainly analogies in terms of the way the credit markets were trading versus that.
Yeah. Well, I guess you could see LTCM as a parallel with the risk parity trade of the day, couldn't you? Which was, you know, this Ray Dalio-inspired mega trade that took off over the last 10 years, where you had very heavily leveraged funds that would balance leveraged bond portfolios versus leveraged equities. And they were forced, as the thing crashed, to sell both. And, you know, as everyone was on a mad dash to get liquidity, they had to sell, both portfolios, leading to a spike in sovereign bonds. So it's not dissimilar to LTCM, I guess, yeah. So that culminated in kind of mass central bank interventions, as we saw all last week and even earlier this week, over the weekend, and the Fed was still extending what it was lending to. And much of that sort of quantitative easing now is done, with just about every central bank everywhere inevitably, you know, passing their whatever it takes moment. Just briefly, I think the RBA actually, although they were slow to do it, did a really good job. And their QE is like the Fed's, is basically now unlimited, in that they've gone after yield curve control. And so they just have to keep printing and buying until, you know, the yields hit their targets, which is terrific. And that kind of gives us some fiscal firepower to fight the virus. So that has sort of loosened things a little, but I've just got up one final chart here, which is Westpac 5-year CDS, which basically shows that funding markets for banks are virtually or in practice still locked up. So despite the central bank interventions, we certainly haven't gotten back to private funding for banks. One of the RBA's other new facilities was the $90 billion fund for the banks to sort of rotate their term funding, and they'll be using that extensively as a result, I think. So the point we've reached is we've been through an historic shock, historic in a number of ways, in terms of certainly pace. It was one of the fastest shocks ever by a long way. GFC took, you know, sort of 13 months to unravel. This took 3 weeks in terms of depth and breadth. It was something very extreme. So markets have kind of taken a breath since then, and we've seen some slight loosening, tightening in spreads and some loosening in the selling in the equity market. But we thought we'd do this one today basically because we don't think it's over. And so that brings us to our second kind of discussion point today, which is blows to come. And, you know, as that first chart that we looked at, the FRAOI spread, suggested, the stress so far has not been in the banking system much. And, you know, many commentators are sort of pointing to that as a great strength of where we're at. And it is certainly true that this crisis has not arisen from the banks, which is great. Unfortunately, as we see it, it's going to end in the banks. And the simple reason is we've got massive levels of default coming in households and corporates arising from these economic shutdowns. Now, we've got all this stimulus out there as well to help it, but, you know, it can only really mitigate things at the margin. The amount of shutdown is immense. We've got virtually a third of the US economy shut down. Australia is heading towards complete. You know, Europe's heading towards complete, and you know, China's opening up, but the, you know, various slabs of Asia are still getting worse and shutting down. So it's just some enormous quantity of the global economy is going to be doing absolutely nothing at all for the next 6 weeks, and that's just inevitably going to smash cash flows, and you're going to see all sorts of profits. And you know, this brings us to our next chart, which is one we've shown repeatedly over the last kind of 6 to 12 months, and that is the, you know, corporate debt to GDP ratio in the US, where we're at the credit cycle peaks, highest peaks ever. And so you have a shock of this magnitude hitting that kind of leverage, and you're going to get some pretty serious credit shakeout in the real economy, not just in credit markets, but in the real economy, and that will land on banks.
Yeah, and one thing to note, Dave, you're just talking about how fast it's actually been to get to this stage. That's part of the issue is because it's been so quick to get to this stage, companies haven't had time to go broke yet, and people haven't had time to pull back spending as much as as much as they will do over the next few months. And so you really, to sort of look and go, well, we haven't had many defaults yet. Maybe it was fine and everything's great and it's time to get back in and buy, saying, well, you know, if you've got companies that went broke after 3 weeks of not having enough money, then those companies were already pretty shaky and we're probably going to fall over pretty soon anyway.
Like, it's, well, I mean, that's exactly right. I mean, as an example, I look at something like realestate.com.au, which is down, I think, you know, somewhere between 20 and 30% from very high valuations. And yet, I for 6 months ahead, I almost see zero revenue for that company. Mm. But it's obviously not going to go bust in 3 weeks. I mean, it may not go bust at all. But, you know, it's such an extreme revenue hit for a business like that that, you know, even an excellent business, you know, that's highly profitable, is going to find itself in dire straits before very long. Yes, so you're quite right. The pace of it is extraordinary, and you know, it does equate to how these shocks usually run. I mean, that is, you get the big financial panic, and it's not until 6 months later that you really start to get the economic shakeout. Unfortunately, though, you know, in the previous crisis, that shock was the banks, and then we went to the economic shakeout. This time it's the virus, then the economic shakeout, and then the banks. And so you get this kind of rolling crisis that goes much longer and deeper.
And then part of that will then, and as you said, that's the, actually, first, before I jump into how the banks are going, it's that contrast as well people have been making between, you know, here's these multinational companies that have all got their hands out for bailouts. You know, 3 weeks in, you're saying, just a minute, guys, you couldn't last 3 weeks before you need government bailouts. But then we've got these people sitting at home on the casuals and all that type of stuff. It's like, oh, guys, just dip into your savings, you know, to sort yourself out. You know, there's a disconnect there. But sorry, where I was coming to with the banks was, there's this part for companies. Part of the reason why the corporate debt market's locked up is because, with all the supply chain disruptions and demand disruptions, is that a lot of it's just people going, look, I don't know, I don't know if you were involved or what's happening with your supply chain from China, whether you've got enough stuff, whether you haven't got enough stuff, whether you've got parts in Europe that are shut down and all those types of things. So I'm not going to lend money because I just don't know what the exposures are. And also, as well, because they're so interlinked, it might not actually be my supplier that's causing the problems. It might be the suppliers of my suppliers or two levels down. And so my supplier, who I thought's fine because their operations are somewhere that's still going, but I didn't know they were relying on other parts. And so that's part of the reason for the corporate sector to lock up. At some stage, you'll end up where the banking sector starts to have the same problem, in that as we do start to see defaults in companies and individuals, then you'll start seeing people looking at the banks going, well, do I really want to lend money to that bank? When they've already, you know, they were a big lender to, say, to a high profile blow up, maybe something like a Boeing or something like that, and then so people are going, well, I don't know where the links are and I don't know where they stop, and so they'll be concerned about which banks do you lend to and which ones don't you lend to.
Absolutely, and then you're into the classic counterparty risk meltdown of the GFC at that point. So you know, again, you go through another whole shock with widening spreads, and you'll need considerably further intervention from central banks and fiscal authorities that will already, the latter of which will already be very stretched from their fiscal stimulus. So it'll be quite a second round. So what will they do to try and mitigate this? We've seen what central banks will do, and we'll see more of it. They'll simply provide liquidity, what we like to call extend and pretend, and that will work to some extent to keep people afloat. But it really doesn't solve resolve a solvency crisis, which is what this is going to be. And so you'll need governments to come in again and recapitalise these banks. There'll probably be nationalisations and quasi-nationalisations on that basis. I'm talking globally. Probably be worst in Europe, we'll come to the Australian situation shortly. We have very leveraged banks in Australia exposed to household debt, obviously, so that will be a problem. We've got this corporate debt monster in the US, which will be need to process, somehow through these banks and through the financial markets as this bad debt gets written down and blasted out. And, it's impossible to know what their figure is, but, Ray Dalio says 21 trillion in Australian dollars of losses. That's going to take a while. Sorry, go on.
Oh, no, I was just going to say, we're happy to move over to the Australian situation. We've got a couple of questions too, gents, but I might just leave those towards the end. Anyone who's listening in, feel free to pop in a question and we can work through those perhaps in the wrap-up as well. So,
yeah. So on the question about extending and pretending, what's interesting there for me is that there clearly are some companies that will benefit from government bailouts where they just tidying them over for 6 months will be fine. Will be enough to let that business continue on and keep going as a going entity, and they'll bounce back quite quickly. And so there's certainly some benefit in the continuity part. There'll be this whole question of moral hazard, though, that's still unclear, and it'll be different from country to country in terms of whether, if you've got, say, in the US, there's cruise ship people who are saying they need government bailouts, and the question there has to be, well, do they need government? Is this a vital part of the whole economy? If the cruise ship does go broke, the shareholders will lose money, the debt holders will lose money, but the ships will still be around and the debt holders will probably become shareholders and then try and get those ships going again, once the economy finally picks up and the quarantine stop. But it's not like it's a, and let's use that as a good example of a sector. It's not like as if you're going to lose things from the economy by that happening. Exactly. But where the moral hazard comes from is if you then say, okay, let's actually bail those guys out and you get through the period and quarantine start lifting, but people don't want to go cruises anymore and you have a sort of a 50% drop, say, in demand just because there's this whole idea of floating petri dishes and people are just turned off that idea. And so do you then have to keep extending more credit to that sector and more credit, and you end up with these zombie companies that are just sort of left there, which you've bailed out the first time, and because you've bailed them out, you feel as if you have to keep going. And so that's where this whole moral hazard needs to be, governments need to be quite careful in it, but for investors, we need to be sort of looking and saying, well, which are the ones where they've been bailed out, but that's not going to help. It's actually just going to be a longer-term problem for the whole sector versus ones where you might actually see companies fall over and those companies will disappear from the sector, and that will actually mean the players that don't fall over actually get stronger and get better profits and can then grow more quickly into the post the crisis.
Absolutely. Actually, just one question, just while we're talking about central bank activity, we've got one here. Do you see the Swiss central bank intervening in the euro and the Swiss franc? Second question there, do you see the Indian central bank running out of FX reserves, gents?
Oh, goodness. Well, I'm not an expert on either of those nations, but I can add a bit of context, I guess. I mean, the Swiss National Bank has done so before against the euro, so it may do so again. That said, you know, the euro has been falling. Oh, hang on. Versus the euro was the question, was it?
Just intervening in the Swiss Central Bank intervening in the euro versus
right.
The,
yeah, so the Swiss EIB, I haven't even looked at the Swiss EIB, but I imagine it's rising as a safe haven currency. So, look, quite possibly they would intervene. Yes, they've done so before. The Koreans are doing it already. No doubt various other central banks are doing it on the quiet. So, quite possibly. And India, I don't know what their FX reserves are, but if the crisis runs long enough, then absolutely we could see some external funding crises in emerging markets, you know, especially if the US dollar continues to climb as we expect it will as we go through this sort of second leg of a financial crisis, then, you know, that would make it a much more enduring crisis and is likely to involve draining of FX reserves around the world. I can't comment specifically on India. I can simply say that that will be a difficult scenario for all emerging markets.
Sure thing. All right. Thanks for that. We'll jump across to the Australian situation, fellas.
Yeah. So obviously the Australian risk, we all know very well, we've actually got quite low corporate debt, but huge household debt, and households are obviously massively under the pump here. There's a factoid out there in the media just this morning about the MyGov portal, which is where you go if you're, you know, seeking any kind of government assistance, and it was something like 25% of the entire Australian workforce accessed that portal in the last 3 days. And so that gives you some notion of how much distress is underway. And hopefully they will all find the support they need. But, you know, the income shock is unbelievably large and quick. So, you know, we think that that's going to land on the housing market very quickly, along with, you know, massive losses in SMEs and, you know, obviously loan defaults. You know, this is a tidal wave of bad debt headed towards the Australian banks at extraordinary pace. And at this point, we probably should just take a moment to consider how long this will go for Australia. I mean, we're currently headed sort of, you know, stumbling hopelessly towards something like a full shutdown through, you know, confusion and chaos. Our working model or theory for what will happen is that we'll get to enough of a shutdown that, you know, we'll be able to kind of plateau the virus, flatten the curve, as everyone likes to call it, over the next 6 weeks. But sadly for us, we're entering, you know, the seasonal difficulty of winter. And if we do kind of beat the virus back over the next month to 6 weeks and then ease up on that shutdown to stop the entire country going broke, then we'll be in, you know, heading straight into, you know, the virus's home ground, which is winter. And so we may well see a double spike here in infections and a second shutdown into kind of August, which obviously is horrible to contemplate. But this is what I guess slow-mo means when he's talking about a six-month crisis for Australia. That is that the real virus risk may not ease properly until spring and sort of October-ish. And so that gives you, you know, a six-month rolling wave of bad debt that's going to just, it's a phenomenal wave of bad debt coming towards the banks from all quarters. So unemployment triggering defaults on mortgages, obviously, you know, just the whole feedback loop of the shutdown in SMEs and corporates and bad debt coming that way. You know, Aussie banks are sort of in this massive ongoing quasi-nationalised, I suppose, already discussion with government on how to handle it. You know, they're getting all sorts of loan supports, funding and stuff from the government as well as the RBA. But inevitably, this is going to result in some sort of credit rationing in various parts of the economy, because, you know, we've got, you know, there'd just be areas that are harder hit than others. And even though the banks will be getting kind of prompted to fund things on the cheap, they've got their own systems and methods. They've got, you know, they'll have falling capital that's getting eaten by everything. And so they'll simply have to pull back on loans in certain areas, I think.
Dave, so that just on that yep. one, there is a question. It more pertains to the US as opposed to Australia, but I think it's sort of topical at this point. There's a lot of talk about the Fed accepting securities or stocks as collateral from primary dealers, or even starting to get involved in the corporate junk bond market to further stop blowouts of spreads. Do you think, well, the question is, are they legally allowed to do this? And what is your thoughts on the impact of this on their balance sheet and for the US dollar?
Yeah, well, the Fed is buying, I don't think it's buying junk debt, is it, Damo? It's certainly buying.
Not yet.
No.
But I think as well, legally, it's not actually allowed to buy corporate debt, but they've just come up with a reinterpretation of the rules to get to the stage where they are buying it.
Yes, so they are buying investment grade already, and that should help spreads. You would expect investment grade. Falling investment grade spreads should help junk a little bit as well. The expansion of the Fed balance sheet, obviously is a US dollar negative over the long run, especially since the expansion is going to be enormous. If we were in a world of recovery or prospect of recovery, I would certainly be saying be careful of the US dollar falling. Because, you know, we might quickly find ourselves into a kind of reflation scenario where the US dollar typically falls. But we're still just in the foothills of this crisis. There's still huge liquidity pressures on the US dollar worldwide. There's still a mad scramble for US dollars in banks and various other players. I know the swap lines have helped from the Fed, but, when we get into what is effectively going to be a depression and a rout for global banking, can I see people pulling money out of the US and deploying it globally? No. I can only see the opposite of where it gets repatriated to the US and pulled out of fringe markets, as it always does in these crises. And so I think that still overwhelms all of the quantitative easing that the Fed is doing for the short term, and the US remains the safe haven currency while this plays out.
And also other countries are also busy doing their version as well. So, that lessens the relative impact. In the end, currencies are just a relative game between, you know, is it the euro or is it the pound or is it the yen or the Aussie that's the strongest one? And so if one government's busy printing as much as they can, then that currency will probably devalue. But if you've got every central bank printing as much as they can, and they all print the same amount, then in theory, you really haven't changed the relative position of those currencies.
Yeah. And plus the European banking system's in a worse position than the US. Like the US did a reasonable job of restructuring it after the GFC, whereas the Europeans just really extended and pretended. And so if we, as this banking crisis develops, Europe's likely to go faster and faster and harder than the US. And, that does not bode well for the euro. And if the euro is falling, then the US dollar is de facto rising. Or at least the US dollar index is. And so in answer to the question, I don't see the Fed stuff mattering until we're into recovery.
Right. And just to follow on from that one, where do you see the AUD going, both in the short and long term?
Is that all? Well, obviously, we've already visited 55 cents. So we kind of did it in an absolute bolt. And no, I don't think the bottom is in, even though we're up 10% since then. I think that the dynamics we're describing probably the two main things are what the discussion we've just had, where the US remains a safe haven during, you know, round two of the banking crisis. And secondly, the point I made earlier where Australia's just really in the very unfortunate position of having to deal with winter as everyone else, you know, as most of the major economies go into summer. And so the crisis rolls on here for longer than elsewhere and the economic damage. And so, you know, so does the fiscal stretch, the monetary stretch, all the things that would typically weigh on your currency. And then throw on top of that, I don't think China will ever be the same again. Like I think they'll just accelerate into the middle income trap now. And, you know, that means bulk commodities, the glory days are over there. I mean, they haven't busted through this for various kinds of reasons. But if you go out 6 and 12 months and the Vale accident is completely passed, there'll be heaps of iron ore supply, loads of coal, and I just can't see China, I just see China sliding away inexorably from here. And so, for Australia, it really is the end of a kind of economic model. And I just think that the Australian dollar just keeps falling, therefore, until we can restructure towards a different way to grow. So what does that mean for the number? I don't know. I've been sort of saying we could hit 45 cents before it's all over. But I mean, I'm just picking a number out of my butt. For that, I don't know, but I don't think it's bottomed.
Okay, sure. No, thanks for that. Anything else on the Australian situation, or we'll roll on to implications for assets, fellas?
Just, I suppose, a quick description of the way I think the bailout will run for Aussie. I think the LMIs, the lenders, mortgage insurers, they're going to get bailed out at some point. That'll be a kind of backdoor bailout for the Australian banks. And they're going to have to raise capital like there's no tomorrow as well. Then it's just kind of bend over and kiss something between your legs.
Actually, we'll just while we're on that topic, on the banks rather, not the other topic. there is one here from Paul Moore. So therefore, I guess, is it time for the Widowmaker shorts on the AU banks?
They've played out. That's right. They kind of halved. They're all like 16-year lows, I think, the banks. No, they can't be that. No, of course they're not. Or are they? Yeah, some of them broke GFC lows. Westpac did. So, I mean, you know, a bit late for that. Okay. But do I think they'll go lower? Yes. But
well, if there's a bank bailout, will that just mean the end of the equity price before they bail out? Do you think that's the...
You would think so, yeah. So I do think the banks will go lower, but as Damo says, you know, the meat of that trade is already behind you.
Okay. Yep, sure thing. Very good. All right. Well, if you like, we can jump across to implications for assets.
So, yeah, well, we think that the chaos that envelops sovereign bonds is over, like for now and probably for good, simply because the central banks have moved. There'll be another question over those if we're right about this banking crisis and the various bailouts and, you know, future emergency measures, fiscal emergency measures that will be needed might spook the market again. But, you know, again, like, well, this will be kind of mid-depression and you'll have no inflation. We had no inflation during the recent bond sell-off. In fact, it was going completely the other way, inflation rates.
Yeah, actually, that's the point I wanted to make, David, is there's been a lot of, you know, there's you often hear the talk about the bond vigilantes, and that was the reason why people were saying bonds were selling off, mid-March, where you had that both bonds and equities both selling at the same time. And you know, there's a few headlines around saying, oh, the bond vigilantes are here and all this stimulus, they're worried about inflation. But inflation, the implied inflation on inflation-linked bonds actually tumbled, probably about halved over that same time period, which sort of gave you that clear impression that people weren't worried at all about inflation. Like the implied inflation sort of 0.5% maybe, whereas it's usually up, you know, well above 1% in the US and closer to 2% in Australia. So, in terms of that sovereign bond sell-off, the fears of inflation are a long way away still for our part. that, you know, even the huge sums you hear about that you're hearing government's going to spend in terms of stimulus is not going to be enough to spark inflation anytime soon, while you've got rising unemployment, and while the money they're spending is effectively just partially replacing the money that people would have spent if they had the desire to, or the wherewithal to.
Yeah, very partially, I think. Yeah. But we might still see some ructions from time to time if a bank's bailed out, or God knows what. If there's just a lot of bonds that the market gets spooked by the future of so much debt being issued at the sovereign level. That said, you know, we've now got printing going on everywhere, and so the central banks just will step up and buy more of it if we do see it. So we basically see sovereign bonds as, relatively secure now. Further weakness for banks.
The other one quickly as well on that as well is, there's talk about can governments afford the interest bills on all these? And I guess that's part of the reason why we see bond rates staying down and staying down for a long time, is because people are right that if interest rates rose 2 or 3%, then governments would be insolvent and couldn't afford their interest bills, especially with all the big spending going on. And that's the exact reason why you won't see that, is why you will see central banks keep pushing those yields down, because the bond vigilantes are much more a figment of imagination than they are based on anything particularly real.
Yeah.
At this point of the cycle.
Yep. So all of those things that we've described, really, I guess you could put in further weakness for bank funding. Maybe a better way of saying that is just saying further weakness for bank profits and margins. And so, difficult to get credit. And property, is going to have virtually no transactions for 6 months. So I just think it's going to reopen 20% down when it does reopen. Then we'll have all sorts of, difficulties getting credit then. And this is before we even imagine, the ongoing wrestle with the virus if it comes to a second wave. So some significant property devaluation ahead. As we've discussed, with all of these kind of depressionary forces rolling through the economy and the financial system still to come, more downside in shares. Stocks generally, in what is shaping as a bona fide bear market.
Very good. David, I've got a listener, Haptic, has been patiently waiting for 40 minutes for this question, so I'll hand it over to you now. And it relates to gold. So he's basically saying, David, I know you like to say that gold will go up after it crashes with everything else. This is based only on one data point of personal experience, though, isn't it? Are you and or Damien, or is it your view, that this is what will take place this time? And if so, how confident are you? I'd be very interested to hear your thoughts and macro views.
Yeah, I'm still confident of it. I don't know how confident, but I'm only confident because that's been the character of it over several cycles. If we're right that the US dollar will remain the safe haven bid, that's intrinsically bad for gold, but that doesn't mean it wouldn't go up anyway. It's possible it would, but what just seems to happen when you get these financial crises, like for this first round being kind of risk parity, equities and sovereign bonds, etc., and the second round we're describing is more bank-based, when you get those kind of crises and liquidity is at a premium, then people just sell what they can sell, and gold seems to cop that. So far it hasn't sold as much as it did during the GFC, but during the GFC it was a banking crisis, and that's kind of what we see ahead. Take from that what you will. It's possible that gold doesn't sell much further. I definitely think it's a recovery play still, for the same reason that I said you wouldn't want to be in the US dollar over recovery. So my basic position on gold at the moment is buy the dips. You want a dollar average on all these things. But I think it's likely gold will probably get hurt a bit more. But it's a buy the dips play right now for the recovery for when it comes.
Okay. Yeah, sure. All right. Fantastic. And just one last one. I think that's probably to both of you and perhaps to Damien more specifically. Does Nucleus Wealth Fund see opportunities in the current crisis? As an example, looking for companies that are or could benefit from COVID-19, examples being firms selling disposable personal protection equipment, PPE, disposable gloves, masks, bodysuits, and just leaves with a note, unfortunately, the ASX doesn't seem to have a dedicated toilet paper or hand sanitizer manufacturer. So what are we looking at stock-wise for the stocks we are holding, and what work's being done there, fellas?
Yeah, I think it's too late. It's way too late on those trades. Those are the trades we made in end of January, early February. They're the types of stocks we were looking for, and picked up a few of them. Most of them, as you said, are international based ones. Some of them are sort of Clorox was one that did very well for us throughout the crisis. They're sort of one of the biggest bleach makers in the US. Essity, which is a Swedish manufacturer of all the hand sanitizers and all those types of. They're a big supplier to hospitals, one of the big suppliers to hospitals. Gilead, which is sort of a stock that's got a mooted potential cure or potential sort of vaccine for it. There's a number of other stocks that we've got in our portfolios around that theme. I think it's too late, way too late for that though. Those stocks are already quite expensive, and we're trying to work out what we're going to sell into as we're selling those, because they are getting just very expensive relative to other stocks. So the real benefit, the real sort of opportunity will be upping the quality and finding stocks, you know, good stocks that are beaten down in the crisis. The issue is making sure you're finding ones that will make it through and ones that won't.
It'll survive.
It'll survive, yeah. That's probably one of your first steps, is making sure you haven't got too much debt, because if you're carrying too much debt, then quite often the company itself will survive. The shareholders just might not be the same shareholders after the whole thing's passed. But also just the whole patience angle. Like it's amazing to me that, you start this crisis. Are we 4 weeks yet? I don't know. It might feel like a long time, but it's not really been very long in terms of market fall. And there's already this, let's reposition our whole portfolio for the upswing, is saying, well, how about we just wait for the downswing first and wait to see how bad economically it is. Because even if you do see sort of recoveries in profits and we haven't even seen the fall in consensus earnings yet. You know, companies have generally been pulling forecasts and analysts have been very, very slow to downgrade earnings. So we haven't really seen how far earnings are going to fall. There's going to be a bunch of different effects that's going to keep earnings low. We think that debt will be structurally lower for all companies.
Can I just ask you, Damo? So, I mean, if it's the case that the consensus earnings haven't been falling because companies basically haven't been issuing guidance, then, you know, that shapes as a big earnings gap, right? I mean, at a certain point when the companies start to issue their real results, you know, they're gonna just dramatically undershoot consensus.
Yeah. it's that interesting thing where I think there's in the ordinary times, I think there's a lot of analysts who are very focused on what is the company telling me? That's what I'll do, plus or minus a small amount to sort of fit my, whether I'm being bullish or bearish. It's in times like this where the company's basically saying, well, we don't know what we're going to earn. And a lot of the analysts who are very company and sector focused and don't have a big sort of macro view end up in the same bit. We're going, well, how could I tell you what the company's going to earn? The company can't tell me. And so it's like, and so that's where you get the more the macro views and the market itself just working out, you know, the stocks have fallen 30, 40, 50%. So what we're seeing is the companies aren't giving the guidance. The analysts, therefore, are generally not updating their models or very slow to. And so what's happening is the market's doing the work for them. So the market's actually downgrading. And because in the end, the buyers of it, even if analysts can't come up with a number for them, they do have to come up with a number to try and work out, or at least a back of the envelope calculation as to how far it's going to fall. And that will give you that throws out opportunities as well. Like there's certainly stocks in sectors where we're looking at that. There's two stocks in there. We happen to own one that hasn't had a profit downgrade. There's another company we'd actually be happy to own, similar sort of quality, and it has had a profit downgrade and fallen a lot further. Well, there's a chance now for us to switch out of the one that hasn't had a profit warning yet and into the one that has. And so the original, sorry, that was your question, David. What was the I was chasing down the original one, wasn't I? Can you just remind me of the original question, Tim?
Yep. So hang on, bear with me. We've got, hang on.
Sorry, yeah, that's right. Basically coming back to saying, yeah, there's got to be the patience.
The opportunities. Yeah, the opportunities. Yeah. There we go. Yep.
So you know, you really do need to be patient. Like, it's 3 or 4 weeks in. You know, if you're itching and you have to get your money back into the market after 3 or 4 weeks, then good luck. You're into the trading part. There's certainly things we're doing and switching around and all that. But in terms of a wholesale putting our money back into the market, we think it's very easy, very early to be calling everything fixed and solved. Sort of 3 or 4 weeks into a crisis that could, we haven't even seen the debt. We haven't even seen companies starting to default yet.
Yep. And do you think a big part of this will be like as some sort of an indicator is just the global case count? Is that something that, you know, obviously in large developed countries perhaps, or just total global case count? Is that, you know, for someone who is eager, like obviously it's still rising, so it's not creating much of a buy case at the moment.
Oh, and look, you're going to get some great rallies in the market. Yeah, like when the case count does turn, you probably will see a 20%. You know, rise or at least 10-20% rise in the markets in terms of that, just off the whole back of that, and that could come all in 2 days. You know, the way markets are going at the moment, but the issue for me is from the financial point of view, it's not as much about the case count as what it is about the financial impact. So if you see economy lock right down, that's going to be great for in terms of bringing the case count down. But it's going to mean there's more companies are going to fall over, and I'm not saying people shouldn't do that. They absolutely should do that because it's going to save lives and it's going to be extremely. It'll be eventually beneficial.
Yeah, very good. Couple of other ones just that have popped in while we've been talking now. The view on what is your view on the future of quantitative peopling from Vivian? So large scale departure of temporary visa holders or attracting more low skill workers due to the broad benefits for all. How will that play into the property market and general consumption and GDP? Quantitative peopling.
So in the short medium term, wildly negative. A massive unemployment spike not only adds moral pressure to quantitative peopling, which I think the government would struggle to ignore. It's sort of little known that the immigration system is quite market based, and so if you have no jobs, nobody comes. So that's the first point to make. Is it's, you know, over the, I guess, next 12 to 18 months, then that. It's very likely, given Australia won't be able to ride this out the way it did in the GFC, that immigration will crash. Longer term, that one's in the lap of the gods. I think given that this is probably a structural shift in the growth drivers for the Australian economy, it'll take time for that to become apparent, but I think that probably is the case. The whole quantitative peopling thing becomes more difficult to justify. But I would have said that it was difficult to justify years ago and it's kept going. So there are a lot of interests that drive it and, you know, perhaps they'll triumph once again. But over the next 18 months, I think it's as dead as a dodo.
Interesting. All right. And we might, we'll wrap up on just one last one. So we've spoken about quantitative peopling. Now it's back into quantitative easing again from Bob. Can the US continue to print or endlessly print money to save its economy? Is this sustainable? As bad as coronavirus damage is showing it could be, could Australia be ignoring the possibility of an external shock further and its impacts on Australian banks? So I guess two-part question there, but...
So I assume there's are related questions in that, like, if the US quantitatively failed, it might lead to an external Australian shock. I don't think the US is going to quantitatively fail, no. There may come a day when fiat currency is cooked, but we're not there yet, and... I just actually think that the Fed has done all the right things so far and has stood behind all the right troubled markets. And, you know, the US, um, as, you know, has this ruthlessness to it that means it can clear out debt at a pace that nobody else can match when it sets its mind to it. It can also accumulate it at a stunning rate, but, you know, it's so individualist and so corporatized that when it really sets its mind to it, and so dynamic as well, then you can clear out debt there at a phenomenal rate. Like the US households, you know, balance sheet is in great shape right now, thanks to the GFC. And I would expect the same thing to transpire for corporates there. And that bad debt will get processed through the markets and through the banks. And you know, the Fed will stand behind it. There'll be appropriate fiscal measures of support. And I think they'll come out stronger, probably stronger and earlier than everybody else. So I don't see a failure of that nature coming. I think the external shock for Australia is already here in terms of frozen credit markets. And the one to come is going to be China. That is not in the next, like it kind of is in the next 12 months, but isn't. Like, I just think that bulk commodities from this point on just keep sliding for years and years and years. And I think that that's the, you know, just the ongoing correction from the China boom that is over and will continue to slide away.
Okay, very good. Terrific answer there, and that's a terrific session. We might need to wrap it up there just in interest of time, lads. So, look, thanks very much for a great show once again, and for all those listening in, and thanks for all your questions for those people. It's been very active, and I suspect it's going to be very active in the coming months, given that everyone's got a bit more free time sitting at home to check it all out. So on that note, I'll just let everybody know that we're going to be chatting with Marcus Padley, stockbroker and investment manager, and we'll be releasing that one up as coming up as our next show as well, so stay tuned for that one, and we'll catch you all at the next one. Cheers.
Well, that's it for now, and thanks for watching. If you like what you heard today and you'd like to hear more, head over to nucleuswealth.com/subscribe, give us your email address, and in return we'll send you a weekly email with new webinar topics, links for our podcasts, and other news from Nucleus Wealth. I certainly hope you've got something out of today, as I have, and we'll look forward to catching you at the next one. Cheers.